Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The Biden agenda. The president announces a new focus on gun violence through community investment and policing amid a spike in homicides across the nation. Then, crisis in Myanmar. Civilians form their own militias and respond to the country's military coup with force. And the plastic problem, promising innovations that could provide a breakthrough to the plastic waste that goes unrecycled.
We can use different solvents to selectively remove each of the individual components in the plastics. With chemical recycling, you're remaking the polymer.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. A new issue has pushed its way on to President Biden's agenda tonight, the current rise in violent crime, including homicides in the United States, especially crime involving guns. He laid out his proposals today for what to do about it. White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor reports.
Today at the White House, President Biden called the uptick in gun violence in America unacceptable.
We need to keep building on the gun violence and crime prevention strategy we're laying out today. Folks, this shouldn't be a red or blue issue. It's an American issue. We're not changing the Constitution. We're enforcing it, being reasonable. We're taking on the bad actors doing bad and dangerous things in our communities and to our country.
The president announced a five-part plan. It is aimed at tackling gun violence and other violent crimes by using funds from the American Rescue Plan. Some of the initiatives in the plan include giving money to cities to hire more law enforcement officials, including past pre-pandemic levels, buy new equipment and technology for police departments, help formerly incarcerated individuals re-enter society, use resources to hold gun dealers accountable, and invest in community violence intervention programs. Over the past year, major cities, such as New York City, have seen a spike in violent crime, including shootings.
Every time you turn on the news, there's killings, nothing but killings, or someone getting beaten up, or someone getting shot.
The New York Times reported that homicide rates in large cities around the U.S. were up by more than 30% on average last year, and are rising significantly again this year. Meanwhile, ahead of the midterm elections, conservatives are capitalizing on this issue and ramping up pressure on Democrats.
It's impossible to ignore that these terrible trends are coming precisely as so-called progressives have decided it's time to denounce and defund local law enforcement.
That includes former President Donald Trump, who spoke at North Carolina's Republican convention earlier this month.
Look at what's happening with their defunding the police.
President Biden has said over and over again that he does not support defunding the police. In the meantime, the Biden administration's new crime plan has some activists concerned about increasing tension between police and communities of color, especially after last year's murder of George Floyd. They're also worried a crackdown on crime may lead to even more mass incarceration.
They must be taken off the street.
That's what happened after the 1994 crime bill, which then Senator Biden supported. White House officials, though, insist that will not happen this time around. The 1994 law imposed harsher federal prison terms, including mandatory sentencing, and it provided funding for states to build more prisons and increase policing. The legislation has been criticized for its contributions to mass incarceration targeting Black Americans. As the Biden administration lays out their plan to curb shootings and homicides, some activists are sounding the alarm about the unintended consequences. But White House officials tell NewsHour President Biden is not focused on arresting his way out of this problem. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Alcindor.
We turn to the White House and the president's push to curb rising violent crime. I'm joined by Cedric Richmond. He's a senior advisor to the president and director of the White House Office of Public Engagement. Cedric Richmond, welcome back to the NewsHour. Why does this set of proposals, it's an ambitious set of ideas the president has put out here, why is that going to make a difference in rising violent crime?
Well, it's a comprehensive strategy to deal with gun violence and violent crime in our neighborhoods. We see that it's a 30% spike since the last 18 months when the pandemic started. And so what we're going to do is really, really wrap around. So we're going to start with ATF making sure that they're working with local police departments to set up task forces to trace and track guns, make sure that we're looking at the gun dealers that are selling guns to people who they know should not have them or that are reselling guns. The Attorney General announced a zero tolerance policy there. We're also going to put money in cities so that they can hire more police officers, so they can invest in technology like gun detection programs, cameras. They can invest in mental health, substance abuse. And then we're going to put some money in to really try to prevent people from going that route in the first place. So cities will be able to invest in summer jobs programs for their youth, invest in their recreation departments, their education departments. And then the last thing we'll do is make sure that we've invested in the Department of Labor, putting money out there so we can train and help educate formerly incarcerated people who are leaving incarceration so that they can get jobs. And we're urging businesses and others to hire them. So we think that this comprehensive strategy, and one of the most important parts of the strategy, is investing in community violence intervention. Mm. And that's people who go in the community, go into the communities where the crimes are happening, where the victims are located, and make sure that they are dealing with retaliation, conflict resolution, and making sure that they identify, because those are the trusted voices in the community, and we know that that reduces crime.
Is it fair to say that guns, though, is the centerpiece of these proposals?
Guns is one facet of it, but guns are, it's a big problem in our communities, and the violence and the carnage that's caused by it is a big concern, and we've seen the videos out there so far, and we're anticipating, because in past, you see a spike in the crime in the summer months when kids are out of school, the heat rises, and we want to make sure we get in front of that, and we want to stop the proliferation of guns all across our streets and in our communities.
We've talked with some activists who are out there who have seen what's happened, especially to young black and brown men and women in this country at the hands of police. They're looking at this. They like some of it. But they're also concerned that more money to police could lead to beefing the police up in a way that's just going to stoke some of the bad, some of the worst instincts that are there. How do you respond to them?
President Biden has always been consistent that he does not believe in defunding police, that he believes in investing in law enforcement and making sure that it's real community policing, where they get out of the police car, where they get to know the people in the community, and you rebuild that trust between the community and the police that police those communities. And we think that that is an important avenue to fight crime. And so the president has been consistent on it. That's his position. And we think that it's going to have a very beneficial effect to keeping communities safer, reducing the trauma in those communities, and more importantly, protecting and saving lives.
How will the administration monitor that money that goes to police, though? Is there a way you can ensure that it won't be used mainly to target communities of color? How do you keep an eye on that?
Well, that's what the Justice Department is there to do. And again, this money will be ARP money, American Rescue Plan money, that has been sent to the cities and the states so far to help them with their budget shortfalls caused by the pandemic. And so a lot of municipalities had to either lay off police officers, cut overtime, and all of those things. And at the end of the day, this is about public safety, protecting lives, protecting property. And we believe that the police can do this in a constitutional manner and in a community-oriented policing, which the president envisions.
Cedric Richmond, we know that these are problems you've described for us in the last few minutes. They've been with this country for a very long time. What makes you confident that now is the moment when this administration or anybody can make a difference?
Because I think it's a comprehensive approach. I think it's utilizing community violence intervention programs and interveners. That's never been funded to the extent that we're going to fund it and that we're going to encourage people to do it. Also, investing in technology so that, for example, one of the police officers was talking about their ability to share information and work with ATF. They were able to monitor social media, and they could identify conflicts before the people actually met and had the altercation or other incidents. And so we believe that through technology, through community violence intervention, through supportive programs, substance abuse, mental health treatment, all of those things, we believe, create a way that we can put our hands completely around this issue and start to deal with it once and for all.
And just one other thing, we saw a report late today, Senator Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina, who's been very involved in negotiations over police reform legislation, the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. He's saying today that it looks like they're close to an agreement. How much difference will it make if that legislation is passed?
Well, we need it to pass. One, we need to rebuild trust between the police, the communities that they police. But two, we need to have accountability and transparency in our policing. We know that the overwhelming majority of police out there sacrifice to make sure that our communities are safe and that they do a good job. But for those that are not good police officers, we have to have a way to hold them accountable and be transparent about it. And so I think that it is a very important. I hope the senator is right. And I think that it can only help between trust between police and communities.
Cedric Richmond, senior advisor to President Biden, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And now for a different perspective on President Biden's plan and its impact on police reform, I'm joined by DeRay McKesson. He's a co-founder of Campaign Zero, which aims to end violent acts by police. DeRay McKesson, welcome back to the NewsHour. What do you make of this multi-pronged, multi-part set of proposals by President Biden?
So in some ways, there is some good news here, right? That there's a focus on manufacturers, there's a focus on gun dealers in a way that we haven't seen before. Because you know, like I know, that Black people are not building guns in their backyard. We're not making them. We're not, like, they're coming from somewhere. And focusing on manufacturers and dealers is actually a really good thing. We always get nervous when people talk about gun control because we don't want guns to become the new drugs, right? That, like, people get so freaked out that all of a sudden we create these mandatory minimums. We believe as a matter of public policy that putting people in jail is the best way to deal with users, when the reality is, just like drugs, people are not, like, making cocaine in their backyard in the hood. They're not doing it. It's coming from somewhere. So that's, like, the first part. But then, like you talked with Cedric, there's a lot of it that is troubling. It is not convincing that the police need more money to do their jobs. And when you pressed about, like, how will there be any accountability on the money, you didn't get an answer, right? So we see this a lot with the federal government. The federal government, there's a law that requires the police departments to, at the basic level, say who they kill. And only 40% of police departments report that data to the federal government, and there's no accountability. So if police departments can skirt the law when it's really clear, I have no faith that they will implement this money and there'll be any accountability. But you know, Judy, what's also really interesting is that the clearance rates across the country have been pretty bad. So homicide has increased. All violent crime has not, though. Property crimes way down. Things like rape way down. But you look at it, and like in Baltimore in 2020, the homicide clearance rate was about 40%. In a lot of American cities, it's not up to 50%. In New York City, it wasn't 50% last year in 2020. So you look at this, and like the answer, I don't think, is actually dumping more money into police departments.
So you're saying, when you say clearance, you mean that they're finding who the perpetrators are. But you mentioned what Cedric Richmond had to say when I asked him about money to police. He did say that they care about accountability, that they want to make sure that, in his words, the majority of police who act with responsibility, that's one thing, but those who don't are held accountable. And he said that is something the administration will keep an eye on.
Yeah, I'm just saying we got to see it, though. It's one thing to say it in a press clip. It's another to have an executive order or some policies that actually back it up. So we think about part of this plan is actually going to allow the ATF to go into communities even more in a more expansive way and partner with local law enforcement. The ATF doesn't have a lot of rules around use of force right now, not very aggressive. There's not a lot of accountability in that department. They could do that with the stroke of a pen. They don't need Congress to tighten up the ATF or any of the federal agencies like Border Patrol, which is 20 8,000 police officers, one of the biggest agencies in the United States. So it's one thing to say it on the news. It's another thing to actually put in a plan. Now, the George Floyd Act would do a lot of good things. If that does not pass, or if it doesn't pass today, the administration can at least, at the very least, rein in the federal agencies like the ATF that are part of this plan that's being rolled out. And they've not yet done that either. Now, the other good part of the plan is the focus on reentry and the focus on violence interrupters. But you know, like I know, one of the what's interesting about this homicide spike is that it's an anomaly in the longitudinal data, and it's sort of uniform across cities. And you think about what's the only other uniform thing? The pandemic, you know? So what would it look like to do another stimulus, right? The economic anxiety, unemployment, those things are leading to crime.
Well, let me ask you about the money. I mean, part of this proposal, as you heard Cedric Richmond refer to several times, and the president, they want to invest money in the community. And you just said it, violence interrupters. They want to, in his words, they're going to spend more money than has ever been spent in the community addressing these issues before they become an issue.
Yeah, but the hard part, and this is, I don't even mean this cynically, what happens when the police are the violent people? Who interrupts that? So in Baltimore, we had an entire task force, the Gun Trace Task Force, an entire task force was indicted and convicted for participating in crime, for selling drugs, for stealing drugs, for beating people up. So what, giving more money to them is not a fix, and they were the task force solely devoted to guns, right? So I say this because what we see across the country is that just investing more money in police, literally, it's just not changing the numbers. So and the police at their best get there after the crimes occurred. We actually have to start investing in the things that encourage people not to commit crimes in the first place. And that is deeper than reentry. It's deeper than just violence interrupters. It will be things like more stimulus money. It'll be just straight outright resources to communities.
I just want to ask you, I mean, do you see, you know, with your point of view, coming, seeing eye to eye with President Biden ever when, as you just heard Cedric Richmond repeat, this is not a president who believes in defunding the police?
Yeah, I'm not really hung up on words, right? I want to figure out what are the core ideas and what are the policies. So like I said, if you believe that the ATF should be in communities, and if, like Cedric said, that he believes that there should be accountability, I'm down with it. So let's just figure out what that accountability looks like. At least help me believe what you said. So if that is true, then let me see the federal government rein in the ATF. Let's see some national use of force standards for federal agencies. That you could do that tomorrow and still believe in accountability. And what I'm saying is that we're not seeing those things. We're hearing them. We're hearing them on TV, we're reading them in newspapers. I'm not seeing them in the laws or the policies or the practices that are put forward. So this isn't about zeroing out police. I'm not interested in that with this plan because this plan is decidedly not that. But it is saying, like, you can't even show me the research. The government can't show you the research that says community policing leads to better outcomes. You know why? Because there is no research that says that. That is like a police department talking point. And when you say restore trust between communities and police, we didn't break the trust, you know? Like, we didn't do it.
DeRay McKesson, co-founder of Campaign Zero. Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
In the day's other news, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a Pennsylvania school was wrong to suspend a girl from cheerleading over a social media rant. Brandy Levy made the vulgar post while off campus after failing to make the varsity cheerleading squad. The court found 8-1 that the school violated her free speech rights. It did not issue a ban on punishing all off-campus speech. The justices also struck down a California regulation allowing labor unions to recruit agricultural workers on private farms. The regulation was issued in 1975 after Cesar Chavez, a pioneering organizer, pushed for it. Today's 6-3 decision is the latest in a string of setbacks for unions. Members of Congress in both parties said today that they will move ahead on changing how the military handles sexual assault cases. On Tuesday, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin endorsed shifting those cases to trained prosecutors instead of military commanders. But some, including California Democrat Jackie Speier, called for going even further.
It needs to go beyond sexual assault and sexual harassment and include all military felonies. That are all non-military felonies that should not really be handled by a commander, but by professional staff.
Meanwhile, the nation's top general, Mark Milley, clashed with Republican lawmakers over military efforts to address racism and extremism. At a congressional hearing, the chair of the Joint Chiefs rejected criticism of West Point's instruction on those issues. He said, quote, "I want to understand white rage, and I'm white." In Iran, state TV reports security officials have foiled an attempt to sabotage a civilian nuclear site. The statement today said the target was in Karaj City, 25 miles northwest of Tehran. There were no reports of deaths or damages and few other details. Hong Kong's last pro-democracy newspaper announced today that it is closing immediately amid China's crackdown on dissent. Police had raided Apple Daily last week, arresting executives and freezing millions of dollars in assets. The tabloid had been an outspoken critic of Beijing's policies. Back in this country, they're still counting ballots in New York City's Democratic primary for mayor. The city used ranked choice voting, and with thousands of absentee ballots outstanding, it could take weeks to name the winner. Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, a former police captain, built a lead last night as soon as counting began.
We know that this is going to be layers. This is the first early voting count. We know that. But there's something else we know.
Take your time.
That New York City said our first choice is Eric Adams.
Curtis Sliwa, who's the founder of the crime prevention group Guardian Angels, won the Republican nomination for mayor. And in Buffalo, New York, self-described socialist India Walton scored an upset in the Democratic primary for mayor, ousting the four-term incumbent. A grand jury in Texas has declined to indict eight jailers in the death of a black inmate last March. They used pepper spray and a spit mask on Marvin Scott as he struggled and then became unresponsive. His death was ruled a homicide. Scott's family says that he was likely having a mental health crisis. A federal judge today sentenced the first of nearly 500 people charged in the January assault on the U.S. Capitol. Anna Morgan Lloyd received 3 years of federal probation plus community service for a single misdemeanor. She was not involved in any violence. Separately, Graydon Young became the first of the Oath Keepers militia to plead guilty in a conspiracy case involving their role in the assault. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 71 points to close at 33,874. The Nasdaq rose 18 points to another record close, but the S&P 500 slipped 4. Still to come on the NewsHour, an alarming new report warns of climate change's dire and accelerating consequences. Innovations that could solve the ongoing problem of unrecycled plastic. And indigenous people nationwide advocate for the return of their cultural artifacts.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The general who led the coup in Myanmar criticized foreign interference today, days after the UN General Assembly approved a resolution calling for an arms embargo. It comes as a new militia has begun fighting his military. As Nick Schifrin reports, the fighting in Mandalay, Myanmar's second largest city, exposes the country's increasing violence and fragility.
In Myanmar's central heartland, government troops left scorched earth. Last week, residents say soldiers torched the village of Khin Ma. Now, its residents and thousands of families around the country are hiding in forests, scared of the military ruling junta that's hunting them down. Army forces have injured thousands and killed more than 800 protesters. And in Mandalay this week, a regime soldier fired a rocket-propelled grenade into a house full of protesters. But increasingly, the resistance is responding with more force. In cities, protesters build barricades to protect neighborhoods from government soldiers. And around the country, ethnic militias attack army checkpoints. Increasingly, their soldiers are civilians from cities who journey to ethnic-controlled territories to join the fight. For decades, ethnic minorities in Myanmar have fought repression and political persecution by central authorities who deny those minorities full rights. And now that fight has new political momentum.
We may be different in religion, ethnicity. We are human beings and we must respect the identity of the people.
Ko Aung Myeong Min is the human rights minister in Myanmar's opposition National Unity Government. It works in exile or in hiding and was created in response to the February 1st coup that deposed an elected civilian government and installed army leader Min Aung Hlaing. The National Unity Government recently released a historic policy paper that calls for Burmese to have equal rights as citizens regardless of ethnicity.
That is, you know, our bottom line, you know, approach. Make sure that everyone is equal to entitled a citizenship. To stop all kinds of violations, to stop all kinds of corruptions and power abuse.
The statement focuses on the Rohingya, a Muslim minority in a largely Buddhist Myanmar. In 2017, a military campaign that a UN panel said had genocidal intent massacred thousands of Rohingya civilians. More than 700,000 fled their homes. For the first time, the National Unity Government statement acknowledges violence and gross human rights violations inflicted upon Rohingya by the thuggish military. It calls for repatriation of Rohingya refugees and Rohingya birth citizenship.
Everyone born by the citizen of Myanmar are entitled to become a citizenship of the country.
But Rohingya activists say that's not enough.
Unless they acknowledge Rohingya as their own ethnic nationality group, that apartheid and discriminations and treating Rohingya as second class will never end. Citizenship alone cannot address this issue. That's what we all need to understand.
Wei Wei Nu is a former political prisoner. She thinks the National Unity Government needs to use this unstable moment to envision a future, more stable Myanmar, where Rohingya are protected with individual and collective rights.
What they have to acknowledge is Rohingyas are bona fide citizens of the country as a group. We are insistent on the National Unity Government to acknowledge Rohingya as an ethnic nationality group and assure rights under the federal union.
That would push a future civilian government to defend the Rohingya more than in the past. In 2017, civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi defended the military.
Surely, under the circumstances, genocidal intent cannot be the only hypothesis.
Do you expect a future government to hold them more accountable, frankly, than Aung San Suu Kyi did in the past?
The accountability must be ensured in the future.
But right now, the military faces little accountability, and the violence across the country since the coup threatens the state's very stability. A massive civil disobedience movement and national strike paralyze the financial sector. Crowds line up outside banks because of caps on withdrawals. The UN expects half of Myanmar's 55 million residents to fall into poverty within 6 months. And the World Food Program says 3.5 million more people will face hunger.
If the international community, the UN General Assembly and Security Council does not stop the military by taking actions, the country, we are at the brink of collapse.
The Biden administration has imposed 8 rounds of sanctions on military officials and military-owned enterprises, including its profitable GEMS business. And in a rare move last week, the UN General Assembly condemned the coup and called on countries to prevent the flow of arms into Myanmar.
A system built on brutality and bloodshed will not survive. It's not too late for the military to reverse the negative trajectory on the ground. Exercise restraint and respect the will of its own people.
But there is no sign of military restraint or respect. And that means ethnic and economic fissures will continue to grow in the fight for the heart and the future of Myanmar. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
A leaked draft report from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change paints the starkest picture yet of the real and accelerating danger caused by humans' use of coal, oil, and gas. William Brangham has the latest.
That's right, Judy. This is a draft report, so it may still change. And it was obtained by the AFP, the Agence France-Presse, But even so, the report says the threat from climate change is real, it is here, and it is getting worse. It lays out a myriad of impacts: unlivable heat waves, widespread hunger and drought, rising sea levels that'll force millions from their homes, and the extinction of many species. For a UN agency, the draft language is blunt, saying, quote, "The worst is yet to come, affecting our children's and grandchildren's lives much more than our own." For more on all this, we turn to atmospheric scientist Catherine Hayhoe. She's authored over 100 research papers, written many climate reports, and currently teaches at Texas Tech University. She's also the chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy. Professor Hayhoe, very good to have you back on the NewsHour. The UN IPCC keeps saying this is a draft, it may change, but I think it's pretty clear to say this language is incredibly stark for the UN. What do you see as the main points to take away from this draft?
I can't comment specifically on the contents of the draft because it is a confidential document that was provided to governments and experts for review. But what I can say is that the results should be no surprise, because we have known since the 1800s that digging up and burning coal, then, now gas and oil, are producing heat-trapping gases that are wrapping an extra blanket on the planet. In 1965, scientists were sufficiently concerned about the risks of climate change for humans that they formally warned a U.S. president, and that was Lyndon B. Johnson. The IPCC report on the 1.5-degree target that came out in 2018 was absolutely clear. They said every bit of warming matters. Every action matters. Every choice matters. And really, the time to act is now.
It seems that just from what we understand of the draft language, that this points to very overtly so many other threads of our lives: the food that we eat, the air that we breathe, whether we can walk outside in temperatures that don't burn us. I mean, it seems like it is stretching to every aspect of what it takes to survive on Earth.
That is exactly what is at stake. After the polar bear, we're next. Climate change is not something that needs to be moved up any of our priority lists. The only reason we care about it is because it affects every aspect of our lives, from literally the air we breathe, to the food we eat, to the safety of our homes, to our economy, to the health of our children. I'm part of an organization called Science Moms, where we connect climate change to moms and how we care about our kids. And one of my fellow science moms, Jolene Russell, who's at Arizona, she said, you know, I had to wake my kids up at 5 a.m. so they could go outside to play because it was too hot and too dangerous for them to play later in the day. How does that not matter to any parent?
I'm always leery of saying, well, this will be a turning point, this heat wave, this drought, this loss of ice. I wonder, why do you think it has taken us so long to appreciate the severity of this situation?
We humans are really good at psychologically distancing ourselves from things that we think will matter in the future, but not now. From how much money we save for retirement, or how much we exercise or don't, or what we eat and what we shouldn't. And it's the same with climate change. It turns out in the U.S., almost 3/4 of people would say, oh yes, climate change is real. It will affect future generations. It will affect plants and animals. It will affect people who live in countries far away. But when you say, do you think it will affect you, the number drops precipitously to just over 40%. That gap is our biggest problem. Not the gap of people who say it isn't real, the gap of those of us who say it's real, but we don't think it matters.
Right. I remember you saying before about how the two great myths are it won't affect me and there's nothing that I can do. So for this report certainly blows away that first myth, as you are saying. This certainly affects everybody that lives on this planet. What about that second issue, though? For someone who is hearing this news and paying attention to this and despairing, rightly so, what do you say to them?
To them, I say, you know what? Every single one of us can make a difference. And here's the amazing thing. It all begins by talking about it, by having a conversation about why it matters, how it connects to what we're already passionate about, whether we're a mom, whether we live in California and we're worried about wildfires, whether we're worried about bigger, stronger hurricanes in the Gulf Coast, whether we're a farmer, whether we're a business owner, whether we care about national security. Talk about why it matters and talk about what we can do to fix it, from individual actions like efficiency, clean energy, electric cars, reducing our meat intake, eating more plants, to much bigger scale. What can our company do? What could our school or university do? How could our place of worship help? How could our city get in on the action? Cities are really where it's at when it comes to climate action. We have to recognize that climate action is not a giant boulder sitting at the very bottom of the hill with only one or two hands trying to push it up an impossibly steep cliff. The boulder is already at the top of the hill. It's already starting to roll down. It's already got millions of hands on it. It just isn't going fast enough.
Another aspect that the UN report, this draft report, touches on is our seeming failure at doing real adaptation to the threats we're already seeing, from rising seas to droughts to agriculture. What would you counsel governmental leaders to be doing on that front to deal with the threats that are here today, even as we also try to deal with emissions longer term?
Absolutely. We no longer have a choice between cutting our carbon emissions or adapting to climate change. We have to do both because the third alternative is suffering. It's as if we've been smoking a pack of cigarettes a day for years and even decades. You might have some spots on your lungs and impaired breathing, but we don't have emphysema, we don't have lung cancer, and we're not dead yet. So how can we prepare for that future? We have to prepare our water systems, our infrastructure, our buildings, our food systems, even our national security systems. We have to prepare them for the changes that are coming. And we're already doing that. Adaptation is already happening. And along the way, it can save us money, it can clean up our air and our water, and it can provide us with much more healthy and livable cities too.
All right, Professor Catherine Hayhoe, always good to see you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Plastic pollution remains a global threat to our lands and seas. And since World War II, we have created over 9 billion cubic tons of it. But the recycling of it remains limited. Miles O'Brien looks at new ideas and innovations that may enable better recycling in the future. It's part of our Breakthrough series.
Imagine what it would be like to live without plastic.
Do you want to help us put the coffee grounds in the compost?
Christy Twist is determined to make it a reality for her family, daughter Ava, and husband Max Delfero.
My ultimate goal is to not have a trash can or a recycling bin. That's my goal. I'm far from it, but that's what I want.
An engineer by profession, she showed me how she has re-engineered life at their Chicago home.
I made this mask out of an old bedsheet that had a hole in it. I needed baking chocolate, so I chose chocolate wrapped in paper that I could compost as opposed to chocolate in a plastic wrapper. So we've got a ton of bread, which comes in plastic, which is unfortunate. Yeah. But sometimes I'm able to find it in paper, and if I'm ever able to find it in paper, I'll always do that instead. You know, we'll make broth or save things in the freezer in glass jars.
Christy uses an expensive private recycling service because she knows municipal methods offer no assurance the plastic she uses will be recycled, especially since China stopped accepting and supposedly recycling our plastic trash a few years ago. Just sorting it all out is a big challenge. At Pelletary Waste Systems in Madison, Wisconsin, they use conveyors, gravity, air jets, magnets, eddy currents, robots, and humans to divide the contents of recycling bins. They separate, bale, and sell 95% of the plastic that comes through here. But according to the Environmental Protection Agency, less than 9% of all the plastics produced ever get recycled in the U.S. Drink bottles and milk jugs, labeled number one and number two, are most likely to be recycled. But the vast majority is eventually either landfilled or burned. Why? Well, plastics are varied and complex, and most cannot simply be melted down and reused.
So here is some of the virgin plastics that you can manufacture.
George Huber is a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Wisconsin. He showed me just some of the hundreds of plastics on the market, all of them derived from crude oil or natural gas.
So right here, this is linear low density polyethylene, LDPE. This is ultra low density polyethylene.
Food packages frequently contain as many as 20 different layers of chemically distinct plastic formulations to maintain freshness, rigidity, and imprint labels.
You cannot recycle this. All of this right now will go to landfill. There's no technology that's used to recycle something this complicated today.
And that's what you're working on here.
And we are developing a technology to recycle this.
He is looking for environmentally friendly solvents to chemically reduce plastics or polymers to their constituent chemicals, fossil fuel.
We can use different solvents to selectively remove each of the individual components in the plastics. With chemical recycling, you're remaking the polymer. It is identical, has all the exact properties as the virgin polymer, as the virgin plastic. There's no change at all.
He and his team are also working on a technique called pyrolysis, where plastic is cooked in a furnace.
It's kind of like a campfire when you put plastics in your campfire and your plastics heat up and you see those fumes coming from your plastic. The same thing is happening in here, just we're not adding any oxygen so you don't burn them.
In this case, they're turning polyethylene plastic back into crude oil.
So you could use in your car to make gasoline, diesel fuel, but I think the most valuable use of this oil will be to make other plastics.
This addresses one of the other problems with traditional or mechanical recycling methods. The finished products often don't measure up to the virgin material. As a result, pyrolysis and chemical recycling ideas have caught the attention of the plastics industry. The Saudi Basic Industries Corporation, or SABIC, is building a commercial plant in the Netherlands designed to chemically recycle plastic waste. Bob Mahan is the Chief Technology and Sustainability Officer.
That facility that we're constructing now is already committed in terms of volume before we've even had it constructed. So I think it gives you a sense of what the engagement is like in the value chain today.
Did that surprise you a little bit, that there was that kind of demand?
It doesn't surprise me today. But I think if you had asked me that question 5 years ago, I think we would have gotten a different answer.
Still, advanced chemical recycling is not the sole answer to the plastic waste crisis. Improving existing recycling technology is also important.
This is the Polymer Engineering Lab.
Tim Oswald is a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Wisconsin. His lab is filled with equipment designed to process and evaluate the performance of plastic polymers. He's trying to refine the traditional approach, creating new ways to identify and isolate specific types of plastic.
So just as a blanket statement, it is possible to make recycled plastic as good as new.
Yes.
But that's a bit of a problem?
It's a bit of a problem. I mean, obviously we have to clean them, we have to separate them, we have to make sure that you have the same type of that material. That's technology that we're working on.
But as long as people view plastics as cheap and disposable, recycling will face an uphill challenge.
I think it's going to take a major mindset shift to see fossil fuels and plastic, which comes from fossil fuels, as a limited and precious resource that we need to think so carefully about how we're using it and how we're disposing of it.
And remember Christie's husband, Max Delfero? He is a chemist at Argonne National Laboratory working on advanced plastic recycling techniques. His lab is developing a process called hydrogenolysis to chemically recycle plastic, including bubble wrap.
The chemical structure of this product from the bubble wrap has the same structure of the synthetic lubricants that you find on the market.
So I'm never going to look at a plastic bag the same again. Do you? Do you look at them differently now?
I see an opportunity. Yeah. There is already a lot of talking, for example, to do urban mining.
Urban mining. Imagine that. An oil patch in a landfill. Now there's a solution that will play well on the home front. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Chicago.
A mass grave with the remains of 215 children was recently found near the former site of the Kamloops Indian Residential School, a boarding school in British Columbia, Canada. It closed in 1978. It was a shocking discovery and part of a dark history of forcibly assimilating Indigenous people. Indian boarding schools have a long history in this country as well. Just yesterday, Secretary of Interior Deb Haaland announced a new federal initiative that will, quote, uncover the truth and the lasting consequences of these schools. Jeffrey Brown has the story of one of them and an attempt to understand and acknowledge a troubled past. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Portraits of a lost time. A painful time for many, a boarding school for Native American children.
And then we also had this photograph.
Okay.
And you wouldn't happen to know what these buildings are?
They were found in an unusual archive in the basement of the St. Benedict's Monastery in St. Joseph, Minnesota, by students at the adjacent College of St. Benedict, including Baylen Benway.
So the first time that I went into the archives and I saw the first photo, it was really just life-changing for me, honestly, because you got to see this whole other side of history that you don't really get taught about a lot. I found out that a lot of the pictures had never really been seen before. Like, they didn't even know that they had these photographs until we were out looking for them.
Some 3 hours north at the White Earth Indian Reservation, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer Jamie Arsenault was also deeply moved by photographs she'd never seen before.
When I first saw the images, I was thinking about the community, about family members that maybe never seen those images either.
In the late 19th century, the Sisters of the Order of St. Benedict began operating boarding schools for Native American students, including one on the White Earth Reservation. The sisters were hardly alone. From the 1870s to as late as the 1970s, nearly 400 boarding schools, most of them government-run, operated around the country. Native languages, religion, and customs were forbidden. The goal, to separate Indian children from their homes and strip away their indigenous cultures.
There was loss of land allotments, loss of timber, loss of access to water, loss of access to be able to do subsistence living and feed your family. Ceremonies and traditional practices were frowned upon in the sense that, you know, your food rations could be withheld, that type of thing. And in the middle of all of that came this loss of children.
The sisters who came were not, to put it bluntly, trained at all. I suspect most of them knew little or nothing about American Indians at that point.
Sister Carol Berg is a retired historian who focused her doctoral dissertation on white earth and broader assimilation policies.
It was a deliberate act, there's no doubt about that, you know. Some parents were glad to have the children come because the children had a roof over their heads, they had three meals a day. But in the end, I think American Indian families had no choice. I mean, they had to submit to this policy.
By the middle of the 20th century, the White Earth Reservation boarding school became a day school and eventually closed in 1969. But the impact of separation from family and culture, Jamie Arsenault says, can be felt to this day.
It disrupted, you know, lots of families and for multiple generations. You know, and then it makes it more difficult for somebody to make a healthy choice. It makes it more difficult for someone to build healthy relationships.
I knew that there's a very complex history there, that this was an issue for Native communities that had a severe impact on their identities, on their family structures. And I'd wanted to know more about it.
Ted Gordon is an anthropology professor at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University who focuses on Native American studies.
I wouldn't describe it as kind of intentionally hidden in any sense, but was this something that was where students were actively taught about this history, where there were opportunities for people to learn about it beyond somebody who would take the initiative to read the history of the land here, that wasn't happening.
Gordon found the monastery eager to open its archives, and he recruited students like Baylin Benway, herself a member of the Prairie Island Indian community, also in Minnesota, to help gather and study a trove of more than 100 old photographs.
You can see like the emotions and how they like physically lived, because they took pictures of every, they really had a good documentation of a lot of things that went on in the schools. They had the pictures of the bedrooms that they would sleep in. They had a picture of them in class. They had pictures of like every single thing that they did at the schools. So it really painted a strong picture for me.
Ted Gordon and his team then approached Jamie Arsenault at the White Earth Reservation.
And so Jamie suggested, why don't we write a new chapter? And if we share these materials, you know, that's what we're kind of describing as the truth part in Truth and Reconciliation.
It's a small piece of a larger national effort. In 1990, Congress passed the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, an attempt to return human remains and sacred cultural artifacts taken from tribal nations without their consent.
We're really trying to expand the definition of what repatriation is. And so that could be language. It could be an archive. It can be a photograph.
In this case, it's a digital repatriation of dozens of photographs, now accessible to descendants of Native boarding school students.
I think we need closure.
People like community elders Evelyn Bellinger and Joe Lagarde, both had family members who attended the schools.
Yeah, we have to start to recover what is ours, whether it's artifacts, they call, or, you know, our sacred items.
You know, what they have and what, you know, connecting with them. Is not going to change anything that happened, but it's a starting point for a relationship that can help us lead to healing.
It's something that's also weighed on the present-day Sisters of the Order of St. Benedict.
We certainly do regret that we have done some injustice, I think, in the past. Again, much out of ignorance, I would say, not out of ill will. But we must acknowledge, I think, that we have done some wrongs.
And now the monastery has done just that. In a recent letter to Jamie Arsenault and the White Earth community that included an apology.
You were talking about the kind of national moment we're in.
Right.
Do you think of what's happening now between White Earth and the college and the monastery? Is it a good story in a sense, or potentially a good story?
I do, because we're taking a history that is complex and for many people very, very painful. And we're trying to move forward as a country, but I think that we really need to look at some of these past events that are unfinished, right? And we need to really examine that, really look at that, and use that as that impetus to move forward.
Arsenault hopes this will become a model for other repatriation efforts between institutions and tribal nations. But she knows many open wounds remain. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
Such a huge story. So important to follow that. Thank you, Jeff Brown. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.